I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, tensions have been mounting between the U.S. and China, especially with the rise of China as a rival superpower to the United States and its primacy on the global grand chessboard geopolitically. Simply put, we're headed to, or may already even be in, what can accurately be described as a new Cold War. And as a result, there is a bipartisan consensus within DC supporting an aggressive stance towards China. Provocations by either nation could heat tensions up exponentially, causing global risk factors to emerge. Is there another way forward, though? Can the U.S. and China find a way to coexist? Our guest on this edition of the program is Michael Clare, one of the founders of the recently formed Committee for a Sane U.S.-China Policy. And he believes that despite the challenges, China's rise presents to the United States, it also opens the door for opportunities. In any case, the committee believes that this new Cold War could have severe ramifications in the future, and that a different approach to U.S.-China relations is not only warranted, but could also be mutually beneficial to all parties and the world. All that and more is discussed on this edition of Parallax Views with our guest, Michael Clare of the Committee for a Sane U.S.-China Policy. Now, on to the conversation. Welcome to Parallax Views, Michael Clare of the Committee for a Sane U.S.-China Policy. How are you doing today, Michael?
We're just fine.
So before we get into the Committee for a Sane U.S.-China Policy, for my listeners that may be unfamiliar, could you give a little bit of background on the type of work and writing you've been doing over the years?
Well, I've been working in the field of peace and conflict studies for a good 40 odd years. For 33 of them, I was a professor, 5 college professor of peace and world security studies, the 5 colleges being Hampshire College, Amherst College, Smith and Mount Holyoke Colleges, and the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. And I taught courses at all 5 of them, mainly on international peace and security affairs, also in environmental politics, human rights, disarmament, and arms control.
So in regards to the Committee for a Sane U.S.-China Policy, how did this come together and what are its goals?
This came together because I've been worried, anxious for the past year or so about a gathering sense I felt reading the news and following speeches from officials in Washington, a growing sense that the U.S. was moving towards on a collision course with China. and that there was very little resistance to this. Usually in foreign policy issues, you have some debate in Washington. You have people advocating one position and others in opposition. But in the case of China, in recent years, it's all been China bashing. China is the problem. And there's been a consensus, large consensus among Democrats and Republicans alike, that China has to be curbed, that the U.S. has to engage in an arms race with China. And I had a feeling that if we continued down this path, the eventual outcome would be war, and it would be terrifying. So I wrote to all of my friends in the peace movement and said, we have to do something. And people said, well, you know, we're already doing this and we're already doing that. And, you know, I came to the conclusion that if nobody else was going to do something, I had to do something. And so I found a few like-minded souls, and we created the Committee for a Sane U.S.-China Policy.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned that there doesn't seem to be much pushback against a very hawkish, aggressive U.S. policy towards China. What do you think is driving that? Because I look at the work of people like yourself, or you mentioned peace and conflict studies. I was just reading Johan Galtung today, some of his writings. He's one of the sort of founders of that discipline. And to me, a lot of that stuff seems very common sense, you know, diplomacy over war. Why is it that we don't choose that sort of diplomatic path, that there's more of a push towards having a new Cold War with China?
So now, you know, I've thought about this and I have an analysis about that, and I've written about it for our website, which is saneuschinapolicy.org. And, you know, it's a combination of things. On one hand, you have a military-industrial complex. And, you know, I believe that there is a military-industrial complex, and it's very well established in this country, has been for a long time. And you need an enemy to justify ever-increasing military spending. And that's especially true now, because between COVID on one hand and the economic consequences of COVID on the other, well, and add to that the decline in the infrastructure in the U.S., decline in health and education facilities in the U.S., and the climate problem we have. You have a president come in, Joe Biden, who says, my priority is to address COVID, the environment, economic inequality, and that's going to cost a lot of money. You know, he's talking about trillions of dollars. Well, if you're in the military-industrial complex, you're going to worry that some of that money is going to come out of the defense budget. You know, and there are many in Congress who say we should cut back on military spending so we have more money to fix our ailing infrastructure and healthcare system. So the military-industrial complex is saying, no, 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 we have to increase spending because we have this new enemy that's terrifying and is building up its forces, and we've got to spend more money to be prepared to go to war with China. So I think that's a big part of it. That's part of it. Another part of it is that, no question, China is a rising power, and it has ambitions to play a big role on the world stage and to contest the United States for influence. And American power elites that have governed all these decades, Democrats and Republicans alike, are fearful of the rise of a powerful rival. And they believe we have to gang up together to prevent the rise of a rival power. And I think that's a very strong impulse in Washington.
Since you mentioned the military-industrial complex, you know, I'm around a lot of young people. I'm in a college town. A lot of us like to talk about politics. And I feel like sometimes when you bring up the military-industrial complex, people think you're talking about some type of conspiracy theory, or they don't know exactly what that term means. would you be able to describe what do we mean by the military-industrial complex, weapons contractors and whatnot, right?
Sure. Well, you know, the U.S. is expected to spend $705 billion this year on military, and a lot of that is going for defense contractors. And the defense contractors are very clever. For example, if they're going to build a major project, like the big ones right now are the F-35 fighter plane, hugely expensive plane of dubious reliability, but extremely costly. And to garner support for that, they divide up the subcontractors in practically every congressional district in the United States, so that there are workers, there are factory workers in as many congressional districts, especially the ones who are on the House Armed Services Committee and the House Appropriations Committee, so that those figures, Democrats or Republicans, will get pressure to preserve the jobs of those factory workers and all the tax benefits it brings. So they're very clever about creating pressures on members of Congress. And so there's an F-35 lobby in Washington and an F-35 caucus in the Congress, all supporting more money for this weapon that is still yet to be proven to work reliably.
In regards to your second point about the fear of China as a rising power, are those concerns, you think, are there legit concerns the U.S. should have about China's rising power? And how can we deal with China as a rising power? Are we going to have to deal with the fact that maybe we're in a more multipolar world now?
Well, it depends what you mean by legit. It is certainly the case that China is a rising power. No getting away from that. It's likely to have an economy as large as ours in this decade. And, you know, that has enormous consequences. China's also catching up with the U.S. in many areas of technology. And the United States has not faced what you would call a peer competitor in its modern history. It's been a very long time since, the last century. Not the last century, the century before that. That the United States faced a equivalent competitor. So it is going to be a challenge, no question about it. Our corporations are going to have to compete with their corporations for markets, for access to raw materials. So the question is, are you, like in the past, going to have a world war to address this clash of interests? Or are you going to find a way to coexist and cooperate and manage the world in a mutually beneficial fashion? And that's really what our committee is about. We're not saying that China isn't a challenge. It is. But we have to find ways to coexist on the planet with them and find ways that are mutually beneficial.
It's interesting you bring up that this is a challenge. And you also brought up World War. What are the potentials for this new Cold War that I think we're already in it? You know, this is sort of a new Cold War that we're in. Do you think there is potential for it to go hot? And is that the concern of the committee?
Oh, I don't think there's any question that it can't, that it wouldn't go hot. And very soon, very rapidly, for example, both sides are contributing to this risk. And if you look at, it helps to have a map. If you look at the Taiwan and the Taiwan Strait, it's a very narrow body of water. A few hundred miles separate Taiwan from China, and virtually every day, the Chinese are sending their planes and ships into the waters claimed by Taiwan, their air defense zone and their maritime defense zone. in a very threatening manner. And the Taiwanese send up their planes and ships to intercept Chinese planes. Meanwhile, 2 days ago, the U.S. sent a missile-armed destroyer, the John S. McCain, as it happens to be, right in between these forces. So you can imagine how, and these planes are piloted by teenagers or young men, and it just take one guy to shoot down a Taiwanese plane or a Chinese plane, and the whole thing blows up into a big crisis overnight, and you have a war on your hands. It could happen overnight. And it's because both sides, the U.S. and China, and in this case, Taiwan as well, are engaging in very risky, provocative behaviors that make a hot war a real possibility. Same thing, by the way, in the other area that concerns us, which is the South China Sea, an area that may not be familiar to all of your listeners. It's the body of water surrounded by the Philippines on the east and China to the north and Vietnam to the west and Indonesia to the south. And it's sprinkled with little islands that are uninhabited, the Spratly Islands and the Paracel Islands. And these are claimed, all of them are claimed by China, which many of us find ridiculous, but they're also claimed by the Philippines and Vietnam and Indonesia. And every day there are clashes there between Philippine and Chinese ships and Vietnamese and Chinese ships. And the U.S. is sending warships into there almost every day. We have an aircraft carrier battle group right in that area now. So that's another area where a little incident, an unintended clash could erupt and start a world war.
That's a very frightening scenario. And, you know, thinking about it more, it's really quite shocking how a small incident can really set off massive conflict. Like, it's like a domino effect.
Yeah. Well, now, I think, and of course, I as a college professor, you tend to think in, you know, historical terms. I think a lot about World War One, less about World War Two. World War II began in a more deliberate fashion, Germany, you know, deliberately provoking conflict. But World War I was different. That was a time when you had major powers, Germany, France, Russia, the UK, all competing for influence in Europe and Africa and in Asia. And they also were engaging in very similar kinds of provocative behaviors that you see today. They didn't expect a war to break out, but when an incident occurred, the assassination of the Archduke from Austria in Sarajevo, each side immediately mobilized their armies, and virtually overnight, a war began that nobody expected. And it's that kind of scenario that I worry about.
What really surprises me is that we're facing climate crisis right now in the near term or midterm future, I would say. And yet we still have these sort of military competitions going on between different countries, whereas it would seem more beneficial to everyone involved if we began cooperating more to deal with the global crises that we're facing.
Well, I'm with you there 100%. And you would like to think that, but you have this momentum of a militarized foreign policy, and you have nationalism thrown in on the Chinese side. There's been a revival of Chinese nationalism that the Communist Party has spurred on, I think partly to distract the population from economic problems and the fact that the Communist Party is not all that appealing to many people. You know, the the repression that occurs there. But the one thing they've been able to do is whip up Chinese nationalism very successfully. And part of that is that, you know, Taiwan belongs to China and the South China Sea belongs to China. And those are popularly held beliefs. And they think that China needs a strong military to push away the United States from what they claim is their historic area of control, their front yard, the East China Sea and the South China Sea. And on the U.S. side, we also have a history of a strong military and a belief that, that the U.S. is number one. So you have a clash of nationalisms that are expressed through military force.
So in regards to the possibilities for policy that is more cooperative, how would we do conflict resolution for something like the issues with Taiwan or the South China Sea? I know I'm putting you on the spot asking that question, but do you think there are policy solutions for these things?
Oh, absolutely. You know, that's two questions. You know, how do you do it, and what it would look like? And so we have answers to what it would look like. Kind of thing. How you get there is the harder part. One thing that we think is important is greater dialogue between the U.S. and China. During the Obama administration, there was something called, you know, I'm forgetting the exact title, but it was economic and security dialogue with high level every year with a Secretary of the Treasury and the Secretary of State meeting with their counterparts and committees meeting. So you had a dialogue going on where you could say, well, how do we deal with Taiwan? And, you know, each side would say, well, you know, this is our view. And the other side would say, this is our view. And then you could set up committees to figure out a solution. Well, under the Trump administration, those talks were blocked and there hasn't been that kind of dialogue underway. So the first thing you need really is to get people talking to each other, laying out their positions, and then getting people in rooms, you know, where, you know, you could shut the door and people could take their tie off, you know, jackets and tie offs and say, well, you know, where can we find a win-win solution here? What is the best outcome? And that's what you need. And we're not seeing that, you know, what those solutions look like. Yes, I could see what that might look like. And if you asked me a particular case for Taiwan, the South China Sea, there are positive solutions to all of these.
Well, that's one I wanted to ask about in particular. Maybe we could delve into the policy paper that you wrote on January 9th, or that was last updated on January 9th, entitled Minimizing the Dangers of U.S. Arms Sales to Taiwan. What are some of the solutions or some of the ideas that folks can glean from that policy paper?
So what the policy paper says, and thank you for asking, and people who want to read this can go to our website, saneuschinapolicy.org, to read it at length, is that we believe that a U.S. policy of continuously arming Taiwan with advanced weapons is a losing proposition, because China can outspend Taiwan 100-1, and they are, you know. So if we send a few planes to Taiwan, China will build 100 of them, and that's not going to defend Taiwan. If China wants to invade Taiwan, there's only one way to stop that, and that's to fight a world war, which would probably go nuclear. So that's not weapons and war is not going to be a solution. There has to be, again, talks between the Taiwanese leadership and the mainland Chinese leadership with the U.S. at some point to figure out what would be a best possible outcome for both sides that doesn't involve nuclear extermination. And we think that there are ways that this can be resolved, but it has to be done by talks between the Taiwanese people and the mainland people. It can't be dictated from Washington.
Do you think there's a way to bring everyone to the table and not feel like the table is lopsided, if you understand what I mean?
Yes, yes, yes. I understand that. You know, first of all, if it's, you know, if you do this in the glare of spotlights with officials giving prepared speeches, that doesn't work. We talk a lot about track 2 and track 1.5 diplomacy, which for your listeners, track 2 diplomacy is where you have prominent folk get together, heads of corporations, heads of NGOs, maybe former government officials, meet privately where they can talk off the record to hash out solutions. And track 1.5 diplomacy is where you might include former government officials who still have a quasi-government role, who can pass up the chain of command, as it were, ideas for solutions. And only after you've actually hashed out some ideas that are mutually satisfactory to both sides, then you have the presidents sit down together to talk, but not until you've already had these kinds of conversations, off the record conversations, where people have been able to work through their positions. You know, the first time people meet, they're all going to just say that, you know, here's our position, and we're not going to get beyond that. So you have to have a series of meetings where you say, okay, well, we heard you on that, but are you willing to budge, you know, on this one? And if we budge on that one, and, you know, and you work from there to more and more quid pro quo until you come to a place where there's enough for an agreement.
Now, in regards to how the Committee for Sane U.S.-China Policy sort of operates, one thing that I think is very appealing about it is you're not taking a pro-U.S. or a pro-China stance, and I think that's very important.
Absolutely. That's a principle from the start. There are a lot of people who are very angry at China in this country, not to mention elsewhere. For understandable reasons. Many people are angry about China's human rights behavior. I'm angry about China's human rights behavior. You know, on the other hand, there are a lot of people who say, you know, before we criticize China, we have a lot of criticisms of the U.S. And we should condemn the U.S. first before we condemn China. And you're never going to get anywhere if you take one side or the other, because you're going to alienate other people. Our focus is the problem is Cold Warism, as it were, a tendency on both sides to feed this Cold War atmosphere, and to condemn the forces on both sides that fuel Cold Warism, and say that we will both suffer from it if the more we go down that path, and we will both benefit from avoiding the Cold War.
If you or, say, Joseph Gerson or others involved with the Committee for Sane U.S.-China Policy were able to give some advice to Joe Biden, and I know this is a theoretical question, what would that advice be?
Oh, simple. Get on the phone, call up the office of President Xi Jinping of China, and say, hey, Xi, when can we get together? Your place or my place? And let's talk over our differences. Step one. That's easy. Do you want me to go beyond that? And then after that, you know, step two is say, I'll bring along my Secretary of State, my Secretary of Defense, and my Secretary of the Treasury, and John Kerry, my climate envoy. And I want to have them meet with their Chinese counterparts to set up working committees to see how we could de-escalate conflicts and find room for mutual benefit. Let's set up a committee on the South China Sea. Let's see if we could avoid World War III in the South China Sea. Here's my deal, Mr. Biden. You know, you could offer this. We'll probably, your listeners don't know what a FONOP is, F-O-N-O-P, a Freedom of Navigation operation. That's where the U.S. sends destroyers or whatever, warships, right up against the islands that China claims that China has militarized in the South China Sea. We the U.S., consider that Chinese claims and militarization illegitimate. And to show that, we send our warships right offshore with missiles facing at the islands, and the Chinese send up their planes and ships to chase us away. A perfect World War III ignition button, right? Biden did this weekend. There was a phone up. The USS John McCain sailed right past the Paracel Islands, which China occupies. This is insanity. So, you know, we call, one of our calls is that the U.S. will stop these operations if China agrees to begin the process of demilitarizing those islands or something along those lines, you know, mutual risk reduction plan.
So in regards to U.S. and China's relationship with each other, obviously, we want to avoid, you know, a Cold War turning into a hot war, a sort of World War scenario. The other aspect of this is, are there things that the U.S. and China could actually come together on and work together to address? I mentioned global crises earlier. Do you think there's a potential for partnerships in ways?
Sure. Absolutely. The biggest is climate. Because the U.S. and China together are the first and second, China first, U.S. second biggest emitter of greenhouse gases responsible for climate change. You know, and they're also the two leaders in climate mitigation technology. So if the two countries work together, they could make it possible to slow the path of climate change and reverse the path. That's also important because other countries point to our failure to work together as an excuse not to cooperate in the Paris Climate Accord of 2015, like India and other countries that are also major emitters. So if the US and China agreed to work together to reduce the rate of carbon emissions and to partner in international diplomacy, we could save the planet. And let me tell you something. If we don't agree, if we continue down the path of Cold War, not only do we increase the risk of World War III, we also make certain that we will never solve the climate problem. Because if number one and number two don't cooperate in this, then there's no chance of slowing climate change. The Europeans can't do it by themselves. Forget it. They're nice guys and gals, but they're not going to be able to do it without U.S. and China cooperating. So it's essential that we cooperate.
Before we close out, I'm curious. I feel like my generation grew up basically seeing war their whole lives, really, right? I mean, we've been at war. My brother, he's basically lived through these wars ever since he was a little kid, from Afghanistan to Iraq. And I think a lot of younger people even have a hard time conceiving of a world where we're more interested in diplomacy than warfare. What do you say to students that you may have had doing peace studies that, you know, just aren't used to this idea of international conflict resolution, that may even be cynical, I guess, about the prospects for peace?
Oh, sure. I've lived through 40 or 50 years of this stuff, and I'm easy to get cynical. So I have no problem with thinking that way. That's a good question. And I'm not going to give you, a pat answer to that. I do think that there are people in both the U.S. and China who grasp the dangers of a failure to negotiate. Also, one thing that makes this situation different, or maybe not different, but one thing that makes this situation distinct is that caught between the two lie countries that are allies of the U.S., but also partners, trade partners of China, like Japan, South Korea, for example, Philippines. They don't want a war. They don't even want a Cold War. They want stability in the Pacific region. And bear in mind that the world economy has shifted from a European Atlantic orientation to a Pacific orientation. And people of your generation, I'm sure, are pretty aware of that. And that's going to require stability in the Pacific region. So a Cold War with China, a hot war with China is going to, we may not experience the effects of it, but Japan and South Korea, Taiwan, the Philippines will be caught in the middle. And their leaders are trying to intervene, trying to say, stop this, let's avoid a conflict, and trying to find ways to allow a stable Pacific where business can thrive. And there are a lot of U.S. corporations that want that too. So you have a little bit of ballast, as it were, that makes that a lot of people who want to see stability, peace and stability in the Pacific. It's not all gung-ho war.
In regards to, we've talked a lot about challenges. What are the opportunities going forward with the Biden presidency? Because I think the Trump presidency, we really saw this heating up with the trade war with China. Do you see any possibilities of a even just a slight changing in course when it comes to how the Biden administration will deal with China?
I'm a little bit in a wait and see mood right at this moment. I see some good signs and some worrisome signs. The Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, has made some menacing talk about China, as has the Secretary of State. But, on the other hand, President Biden has said that my top priority is climate change internationally. And on that, for that, you have to cooperate with China. And he's appointed John Kerry as his climate envoy. And I've met John Kerry, and I know he's, he was instrumental in negotiating the Paris climate agreement, and he worked closely with Chinese officials to make that happen. So he's going to weigh in on this. And I think that's a positive sign.
Do you think the American people, sort of citizenry, the voters, do you think they can have a role in all of this? I mean, obviously they can support your committee. Maybe do you have any suggestions for what we as everyday Americans can do?
Sure. You know, one thing is to resist where you see it. For example, in academia, there's been a lot of anti-Chinese bias creeping in various ways, prejudice, discrimination, forcing Chinese scholars out of their positions in academia. So people in academia can resist that kind of discrimination and racism. That's something you can do when you're made aware of it. And when bills come up, people can speak with their members of Congress, you know, by whatever means, messaging, calls, in social media, not to throw money at the Pentagon for more weapons to fight a war with China when we need that money at home. That's a simple message. We will be at our website, we'll be covering the bills as they come up for Congress and giving people alerts about when these bills appear, so that if people are interested, they can follow that.
Is there anything else you'd like to add that we didn't cover that you feel is important with regards to the work that the Committee for a Sane U.S.-China Policy are trying to do right now? And also, how can my listeners support the work of this committee?
Sure. Well, thank you for that. Well, people should go to our website. I keep repeating that, saneuschinapolicy.org, because we have a statement people can sign. People could donate to support our activities or to follow any of the action alerts that we will be posting, and follow what's happening. So that's clear. You said to what else to be thinking about. Of course, I'm of an older generation, and I could remember the last Cold War with the Soviet Union. And I could tell you that it's not just something that happens over there that doesn't affect daily life. It does. It affects daily life. And it will, if we have a Cold War with China, it will affect everything. It'll affect education, the allocation of national resources, where our money goes. It'll interfere with efforts to overcome domestic problems that we have, because we'll all be whipped up into a frenzy for a Cold War. Money in sciences, instead of going to fighting viruses, are going to go to perfect new weapons for war with China. So it's something that people need to be aware of, will affect your life.
Yeah, I think of all the debates people are having about the money that should have been allocated to looking into viruses. I look at all the debates around the need to reform our healthcare system. And if we're going to have a Cold War with China, we're probably not going to be able to have those reforms at home.
That's exactly my point. A Cold War overcomes everything. It permeates everything, interferes with everything, and shifts priorities from domestic needs to militarism.
Well, Michael Clare, I want to let you go. You've been very generous with your time. In closing, I always like to end on a positive note. I try, even in these, you know, crazy times. Is there anything you would say with regards to your hopes? I mean, it sounds like you've maintained hope over the years.
I hope that popular pressure makes a difference. So right now, this debate about China has been exclusively conducted among policymakers and pundits and professional, you know, foreign policy experts in Washington, D.C. And the public has had very little input into this conversation. So I'm glad that you gave me this opportunity to speak, because citizens have to speak up on this issue and let Washington know that we'd rather have our resources, national resources devoted to pandemic relief and infrastructure repair rather than a Cold War with China. Very simple.
Well, Michael, Claire, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views, and I hope everyone will check out the Committee for a Sane U.S.-China Policy.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Michael Clare of the Committee for a Sane U.S.-China Policy. Please be sure to check out their work at saneuschinapolicy.org. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Ted, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight. With no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.